Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current status of my Sunday sermon. There's a big division between people about what the church should be about. Some people say the church should be about what these two Japanese millennials are talking about. Now, I talked about this video in a previous sermon where a guy does on the street conversations asking Japanese millennials about religion. What's going on with religion in Japan? And there's Shinto and there's Buddhism, and the church really hasn't taken much root in Japan. But here in this video, these two sound like American moralist therapeutic deists. One woman offers, "I do end up praying for help when I'm in a bind. I think it's okay for God to exist, and it's something important." And so a lot of people say, well, the church is about helping individual people feel better about their lives, helping people connect with God so that God can resolve problems in their lives and do that work. Church is about personal ethics and personal relationships with God. It's about individual transactions between God helping us out of our mess. It's fundamentally about the individual and the personal. There are other churches and people that say, no, the church should mobilize, and the church should be about justice and making society a better place. Now, there are at least two different versions of that. Churches should be mobilized against churches should be mobilized to fight for the right wing of American politics or the left wing of American politics. And that's what the church should be doing. It should be about either individual things or about social public justice things. Now, what do both of them have in common? Just recently, there's a very interesting piece about the political captivity of the faithful. And the byline is, or the subtitle is, "There are things only church can do. It should do these things." And in that article, it had a very interesting little quote from C.S. Lewis. This reminds us of the point made by C.S. Lewis, that it is always dangerous to underestimate the similarities of disputants. Quoting C.S. Lewis, "Nothing strikes me more when I read the controversies of past ages than the fact that both sides are usually assuming without question a good deal which we should now absolutely deny. They thought that they were completely opposed as two sides could be, but in fact they were all the time secretly united with each other and against earlier and later ages by a great mass of common assumptions." That's interesting. And by virtue of quoting it, we might ask ourselves, well, what do the opposing warring factions of our own culture war deeply agree on? And that article goes on to explore some of those questions. It's a very good and interesting article. Some want to see the church used for political ends. And again, both sides in both political parties do this. But both assume in some ways that it's the state or the government that matters. Is God incidental to this? Well, one side tends to, well, is God incidental to this? Because after all, the goal is the state. Does God not care about justice? Well, I think God does care about justice. God certainly talks a lot about justice. But why didn't Jesus call out the injustice and corruption of the Roman occupation in a more straightforward way? That's part of the reason he was killed. Now, the other side wanting divine intervention for personal relief. Does God not care about our individual pains? Well, I think the Bible certainly says God cares about our individual pains. Why didn't Jesus teach his disciples then about the germ theory or sanitation or antibiotics? Whereas he goes about healing people, certainly he could have left a longer health legacy if he had just said, well, you know, there's these little things called germs that you should wash your hands often, and don't put your hands on your face because you can pass around viruses like the coronavirus, or make sure that you have, you know, good practice, good sanitation in your villages. The medieval communities, the medieval Christian communities certainly could have used that idea, would have saved a lot of plague and dysentery and cholera and all kinds of different things. Why didn't he, you know, give the disciples the formula to antibiotics and teach them how to administer it? So does God not care about our pain? I think we would say God both cares about justice and God cares about our pain. Now, both might, or might not in some cases, agree on the religious formula for success, depending on how they construe religion. And, well, you can find ideas just like this, for example, in the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy is very clear. If you obey the Lord your God and carefully follow all his commandments he gives you this day, the Lord your God will set you on high above all the nations of the earth. And when, in Acts 1, when the disciples asked Jesus, now will you restore the nation to Israel? I'm sure this is exactly what they were thinking. And Moses goes on, all these blessings will come to you and accompany you if you obey the Lord your God. You'll be blessed in the city and blessed in the country. The fruit of your womb will be blessed. The crops of your land will be blessed. The young of your livestock, the calves among your herds and lambs of your flocks, your baskets and kneading trough will be blessed. The Lord will grant that the enemies who rise against you will be defeated before you. They will come at you from one direction, but flee from you in seven. And it goes on. But if you go jump down to verse 15, however, if you do not obey the law, obey the Lord your God, and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees I am giving you this day, these curses will come on you and overtake you. And it pretty much mirrors the other side. And again, as we talked about last week, this is pretty much religion. This is what religion offers, what religion does. And as we've been seeing in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has a really strange posture towards default human religion. He sort of riffs on the psalmist's beatitudes, but he disrupts them in a strange way. He basically admonishes throughout the Sermon on the Mount, be careful how you think about and use religious performance. Is religious performance a guarantee that, in Deuteronomy 28, that everything will go great in your personal and public lives? Is failure to perform religiously a guarantee that everything will go disastrous in your personal and public lives? Now, as we mentioned, as a culture, we've spent the last few hundred years taking apart religion as a formula for success in many ways. And it was noted that religion doesn't always work the way, let's say, technology works. You might pray for someone and they still get sick and die. You might pray to keep a job and still get fired. You might pray and it doesn't happen. But then we also noted that religion doesn't never work. And there's been plenty of scientific studies to back this up. Religious people are happier, live longer, more successful, and on average, outperform non-religious people. So what are we to make of this? And what are we to make of this when it comes to Jesus? Because he begins this section of the Sermon on the Mount and says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Truly, I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. And so he's not setting aside the law, per se. He's looking to fulfill it. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. So in other words, he's not sweeping aside Deuteronomy 28, but maybe Deuteronomy 28 as such, in terms of the way we frame it, is not quite what we think it is. Because one of the big lessons that you can learn if you actually read that entire part of the Bible that Christians often call the Old Testament is, we can't keep the law. For I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. That's pretty much exactly what Jesus says. But he's saying it in a way that, okay, so I have to keep the law. And so suddenly I start thinking, well, what can I do that the Israelites didn't do? And how can I achieve in terms of my religious performance where the Israelites failed to achieve? And what can I do? And right away, we're continuing to work the levers of default human religion. Now, the Sermon on the Mount only gets stranger because Jesus continues. You have heard it said, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder. It's like, you can find that in Deuteronomy 5, and you can find it in Exodus 20. It's one of the Ten Commandments, and it's one of the commandments that almost nobody disagrees with. You shall not murder. Now, they might say, well, the killing might be justified in certain circumstances, maybe for self-defense and maybe as a punishment executed by a duly authorized official or maybe in war and so on and so forth. But if there's a commandment that pretty much everyone will agree on, it's this one. And Jesus sets it up this way. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. Pretty much everyone agrees with that. But I tell you, you're saying, but? That anyone who is angry with his brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Oh. Anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raka, is answerable to the court. Oh. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Wow, Jesus is really doubling down. And what's troubling is that, well, a lot of people struggle with the murder thing. But a whole lot more people struggle with the anger thing. In fact, pretty much everyone. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Now, this is a really tricky one, because right away Jesus says, here's an item of religious performance. Before you enter into your public religious performance, reconcile yourself with, well, reconcile yourself with your brother or sister. Now, that's Christian code talk for other Christians, but it goes beyond that, doesn't it? That we should reconcile ourselves and we should cease our religious performance until really the heart of our communion is mended? Well, what if the other person holds out on you? What if they refuse to reconcile with you? There isn't a if they're willing clause in this, and this is one of the reasons that people look at the Sermon on the Mount and they say, this is a little nuts. No one can do this. No one can keep this. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Now this isn't a brother or sister clause here. This is your adversary who may or may not share Jesus' communion. I'll say it that way. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. You know, when I talked about the students in the 1980s at Texas A&M, this is the kind of thing they read and said, this is great moral teaching. This is useful. This is practical. This seems unfulfillable. Now, this really confuses our framework, because we like to think in polarities of kind versus strong. And right now in our culture, Jesus, generally speaking, sort of has a kindness reputation. But Jesus seems to up the kindness factor. Avoiding murder isn't the point. Even your emotional life with respect to others is observed and judged by God, and you're given specific commands in order to do this. In fact, in the middle one, you're told to pause your overt religious performance and fix it first, something that, quite frankly, might not be totally within your control. I mean, we should have a little bit of sympathy for people who read these things and say, this doesn't sound practical. But at the same time, Jesus ups the strength factor. He's threatening people with the fire of hell and saying, you know, you will certainly pay every last penny. This isn't Jesus meek and mild. And so, you know, we might expect to hear Jesus say something like, do not murder, be nice to everyone. Well, okay. And if you're not nice to everyone, you'll be thrown into hell. Well, that doesn't sound very nice. And he goes on with this. I mean, this is just the first one. Then he goes on with adultery and lust in your heart, which is very famous, thanks to Jimmy Carter and many others since then. I mean, Mike Pence won't go out to lunch with a woman, just he and the woman. Oaths and truth-telling. Don't take oaths. And this has caused a lot of conversation throughout Christian history with some Christians not being able to take government oaths in court. And this, in fact, gets highly debated, and John Calvin and Calvin's Institutes will talk about this. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye. Well, isn't that what sort of keeps people from, you know, doing bad things? Because it's the law of retribution, and Jesus says, go the extra mile. And he caps it off, and I think we pretty clearly see, at least in this section, bookends here, which is quite a common way to handle these kinds of long teachings. Love your neighbor, hate your enemy. That's what everyone says. And then he says, no, love your enemy and be perfect like your heavenly Father is perfect. I think I should edit this because I don't think the slide is clear. And this is one of the most difficult teachings that Jesus gives. Now, again, we listen to it and say, oh, that sounds nice. Well, it sounds nice until you have an enemy, until it's really going to cost you. And remember, with Jesus, this was not an abstract thing. He, in fact, had enemies who sought his life and at one point, in fact, took his life. You've heard it said, love your enemy and hate, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. You say, well, I might have a difficulty loving them. And you probably mean feeling love towards them. And, well, we're not really often in charge of our feelings, but then we're told to do something else, to pray for the well-being of those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Now, right away here, we begin to get a sense of what is behind all of these laws, that children of your Father in heaven, these are the people, the children are like the parents. He causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? The tax collectors were people who were considered traitors in Jesus' culture war. And these were supposed to be the most immoral people around, because there's nothing more immoral than stabbing your own brothers and sisters in the back. And Jesus is saying, even they do that. So, and if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even the pagans do that? Yeah, they do that. Be perfect, therefore, as your Father in heaven is perfect. And a long time ago, when I began to read this, I noted that the perfection that I usually thought of God was rule-keeping. And what Jesus seems to be saying here is, well, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. There's also sort of a performative move here in that in doing these things, in doing these impossible things, you actually become the thing that makes you capable of doing it. Now, again, it seems sort of circular, but that seems to be exactly what Jesus is saying. Dallas Willard, in his book, The Divine Conspiracy, which is about the Sermon on the Mount, phrases it this way. To succeed in keeping the law, one must aim at something other and something more. One must aim to become the kind of person from whom the deeds of law naturally flow. The apple naturally and easily produces apples because of its inner nature. This is the most crucial thing to remember if we would understand Jesus' picture of the kingdom heart given in the Sermon on the Mount. Here also lies the fundamental mistake of the scribe and the Pharisee. They focus on the actions that the law requires and make elaborate specifications of exactly what these actions are and in the manner in which they are to be done. In other words, they're instrumentalizing the law in a particular way. They also generate immense social pressure to force conformity of action to the law as they interpret it. In other words, they're working the religious game. And they're working the religious game and saying, well, if you line up the laws and do them, then, on one side of the equation, God will get you out of your bind, put God in your debt. And they're also saying, well, if we line up the laws and put tremendous social pressure on others to fulfill them, then, well, God's kingdom sort of comes and we bring it by making everybody do the right thing via social pressure. They are intensely self-conscious about doing the right thing and about being thought to have done the right thing. That last sentence is crucial. Because this is what we usually do. We strategize to appear righteous in order to gain status through moral performance. This gives us influence over people, and we imagine, again, we're going to, well, move the social crowd and bring in the kingdom by either name your particular political agenda. It can be the agenda of the right and the agenda on the left. They're both playing the same game. We look for a list of rules and guidelines to comply in order to begrudgingly satisfy God in order to achieve something we want. This is sort of the individual game. Well, let me perform religiously to put God in my debt so that God will give me what I want. Both of these moves are condemned. Why? Because neither of these moves are anything of what love looks like. If you behave this way toward your spouse, if you behave this way toward your parents, if you behave this way toward your children, problems develop. This is not what Jesus is teaching. And this comes through in how Jesus worked himself. The Apostle Paul notes this in Romans 5. Therefore, since we have just been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. That part seems assumed. Misery, deliverance, gratitude. Through Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. And we boast in the hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings. Now, this is where it gets really weird. Because sufferings, well, that's losing. That's either losing, well, I asked God to do this for me and he didn't, or I tried to get the whole crowd and the whole country to live this way and the kingdom didn't seem to have come. Because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. And hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given us. In other words, the goal of this is to become the kind of people who can, in fact, live in the way Jesus describes. And if you look at the kind of people that live the way Jesus describes, a little bit later, the Apostle Paul notes, against such things there is no law. Because, well, there are laws against murder, and anger can get you into trouble. But love, generosity, sacrifice, freely given, with no strings attached, well, that just doesn't seem responsible. Neither did what Jesus did. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. This is exactly what Jesus did. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though a good person sometimes might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. In other words, what we see reflected in the Sermon on the Mount is lived out in Christ. Now, this might cause some confusion because, well, Jesus didn't always say the kindest things. Well, because it's not kindness. Jesus would say the best things. Well, the best things towards what? Well, the best things towards our transformation. The best things towards what we need. Now, what to do? Again, what we usually do is sort of what both of these groups have in common. We try to put God in our debt so that he will help us out of our bind. Or we use social pressure or virtue signaling to pressure others to comply with what you think public righteousness should look like. And again, everybody seems to have their own way of doing that. The way the world seems to change, the way hearts seem to change, are the quiet power of the saints. And I hear this often from people. I hear that it's the long-suffering, it's the people who actually don't just look for a law to comply with in order to put God in their debt, or look to try to change other people by shaming them or manipulating them into some sort of public performance, but it's the people who quietly go about doing the right thing, even though many times they are completely misunderstood. And ironically, if you go back and look at the Beatitudes, we seem to find those people there. And these people, it seems, are the ones who actually change the world and who are offered the promises of the resurrection and everything that comes there. The behavior comes out of an alignment with God. They become children of God. And you might say, well, how do I get that? And how do I do that? Well, the first question I would ask you is, do you really want that? Because it doesn't really look like winning politically or getting out of the binds that we want God to get us out of. In fact, it's not something you really sort of do yourself. It's a gift that's given along the way. Well, along what way? Well, it's given along the way of life. Not usually of winning, either privately or publicly, personally or communally. Most of the time, it actually sort of follows with a lot of losing. Along the way of trust, when things don't go your way and you continue to trust Jesus more than you trust yourself. Along the way of obedience, where you continue to, with the myriad of difficult choices before you, when, well, there doesn't seem to be one particular rule that actually tells you exactly what you should do in this moment, you try to actually live out obedience to Christ in the way that you should, often in a costly way. Along the way of discipleship, of actually studying and becoming like Jesus, sort of like children become like their parents, by watching, by taking in their habits sort of automatically, and along the way of suffering. And again, you might say, well, Pastor, this, what is it that we really want? Well, we want, again, some list of rules, we want to turn all of this into a technology by which we will achieve either privately or publicly the thing that we're looking for. And, well, you might want good things privately, and you might want good things publicly, but at the heart of that desire is really the desire to replace God. And if you look at the life of Jesus, who is God, what does he do with his life? And if you can figure that out, and if you can follow him, then over time, you'll be given the gift. The gift of what? The gift of the kind of character that the Father exhibits in a very costly way by the gift of his Son.